Okay, this is Gary Parrish, and this is the IOM College Basketball Podcast again, and I'm now talking to you on the morning of December 16th, which is the morning before tomorrow night's GBB Classic up at Madison Square Garden in New York. Should be a fun week of college basketball ahead of us, even if last week was kind of boring. Semester exams obviously get in the way and interfere with college basketball. Anyway, it's Monday. That means I'm joined by my colleagues at CBSSports.com, Matt Norlander and Jeff Borzello. Mr. Norlander, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Parrish, and good morning, Mr. Borzello.
What's up, guys?
Borzello. All right, listen, let's start by looking back at the weekend a little bit. Obviously, I was in Chapel Hill for North Carolina's 82-77 win over Kentucky. So now the Tar Heels have wins over the schools that were ranked, for whatever this is worth, first, second, and third of the preseason AP poll. Meantime, Kentucky is sitting here with three losses, even though some folks spent October whispering about a possible 40-0 record. Jeff Borzello, I'll start with you. What do you make of the development that we saw Saturday night in Chapel Hill?
It seems like I thought maybe a couple weeks ago they were kind of coming together at both ends of the floor. I mean, they were playing better defense together, and they seemed to have some sort of offensive system. But on Saturday, it kind of regressed to the point of being a little bit selfish. And you know, you could tell they didn't really seem to get along all that well. I mean, a lot of the second half was mostly the Harrisons driving to the basket, which was fine. I mean, it worked for them. They got into the free throw line, but you know, Julius Randle didn't really do anything. I mean, I charted a second half, and he got two touches inside the paint, and that can't happen, especially against the North Carolina team that was throwing Jackson Simmons out there and Desmond Hubert. I mean, Julius Randle should have had, you know, 8 to 10 touches in the second half inside the paint, and he didn't. And I think Kentucky maybe regressed in terms of cohesion and chemistry on Saturday.
What do you see, Norlander?
I see a team that's still young, speaking of Kentucky, of course, that I think is better than last year's group. But I do believe that I don't know why this happens, but I do believe, you know, kind of reverting back to what we spoke about last week, maybe it was a little bit of groupthink with Kentucky, you know, this supposedly being the greatest recruiting class, which, Borzello, real quick, I mean, you still consider what Kentucky has this year to be the greatest recruiting class of all time? Because that was the belief going into this season.
I mean, I still think it's a really, really good class. I mean, in terms of recruiting class, it was the best of all time.
Well, yeah, yeah. Let's talk about
it. In terms of the freshman class, it might not be, but in terms of recruiting class, of what they did in high school recruiting-wise, it was the best one.
Well, let's not have revisionist history here.
Right.
I mean, it is the first class ever to have 6 McDonald's All-Americans. All right? They've been doing McDonald's All-Americans for a long time. This is the first time any school's ever enrolled 6 McDonald's All-Americans. So it's undeniably a great recruiting class, and an historically unprecedented recruiting class. I think if you wanted to take issue with the class, here's what you would take issue with. It's a little bit like the idea in basketball. Would you rather have, you know, 2 quarters or 10 nickels? You see what I'm saying? Like, okay, you got 6 really good players. You know, one great one, I think, in Julius Randle. Another really good one in James Young. And then the Harrisons are coming along, but whatever. So would you rather have 6 really good guys? Or would you rather just have Anthony Davis and Michael Kidd-Gilchrist and some other guys? Or would you rather just have John Wall, DeMarcus Cousins, and some other guys? In other words, is it better to have 6 really, like, one great guy and 5 really good guys, as opposed to, you know, the number 1 and number 2 picks in the draft and then some other people around them? I think that's an interesting debate, but the idea, you know, because I do tend to believe that maybe it's better to have, again, if you can understand the analogy, 2 quarters rather than 10 nickels, or 1 quarter rather than 5 nickels.
I get what you're saying.
I agree, because I think that we all would probably agree that Julius Randle should be their go-to guy. And I don't think that everyone in Kentucky thinks that, obviously. I think that Andrew Harrison thinks he should be the go-to guy. I think Aaron Harrison thinks he should be the go-to guy. And, you know, like you said, it might be better to have those two, you know, guys that you're going to go to at the end of the game or in a big situation. Kentucky has 5 or 6 of them, and that's a good thing, but it could also be we get into a situation where, you know, they're not sharing the ball as well as they should be.
Well, though, on Saturday, they certainly didn't share the ball as well as they should. I mean, it became a one-pass, drive-the-ball offense. I mean, that's essentially what it was in the second half. And I don't know how much the television cameras picked it up, and I wrote about this a little bit, but it the body language and the frustration between the players – was really hard to miss if you were sitting in the arena. In other words, I don't have to wait for a camera. When you're in the arena, and this is one of the really nice things about actually going to games, sometimes people will go, all right, well, with everything on TV now, why do you need to go? Because you can see things in the arena, and you guys know this as well as I do, yeah. that you can't see on television. In other words, I don't have to wait for a camera to get on Andrew Harrison or a camera to get on Julius Randle. I can spend 7 straight minutes watching Julius Randle, just his face, just the way he walks, just his expressions. And I don't want to say I've never, that would be an overstatement, but it was undeniable that these guys were frustrated with each other. You know, Julius Randle, he can't pass the ball to himself. In other words, if Andrew Harrison wants to dominate the ball and get 15 shots, 20 shots, he can go do that because it's the ball's in his hands. He's typically going to be physically overwhelming for the guy guarding him. So there's no reason he can't theoretically drive into the paint every single time. But Julius Randle needs somebody to get him the ball. And those guys didn't do a very good job of getting him the ball the other night. Some of it was Julius's fault. I think he wasn't, you know, probably he shut down a little bit. Like people always talk about, oh, he's got this great motor and he's just relentless. And I believe both of those things are true, but they weren't true on Saturday. He shut down and got frustrated. And it became very clear to me that, listen, they're still really talented, and I still think they can be really good. But the pieces don't fit perfectly, and they don't seem to enjoy each other right now. And it's just little things you notice. I wrote about how, and I think the specific one I remember was Julius Randle checking into the game for Alex Poitras, and they walked right by each other, like most guys do when one guy checks in specifically for another guy. And Poitras had to come from the opposite free throw line, so there was a long walk for both of them. And Randle had to go to the opposite free throw line. So there was a long walk for both of them, and they went right, like they almost brushed shoulders, but they didn't touch. And it's almost like habit now for basketball players. Like you're always fist bumping, patting somebody, you know, it's, you know, huddling, you know, patting somebody on the butt. And these guys walked right by each other. I don't know if they looked at each other, but they did not touch each other. And it just struck me as maybe not a big deal, but it's certainly unique, rare, because and then Cal was spending a lot of time like yelling at them, huddle, you know, in dead ball situations, get together, like put your arms around each other, just act like you know each other. And there was none of that, which I thought was striking.
I think it's been interesting how, you know, there's certainly a validation to the belief that coaching a lot of talent takes a lot of talent inherently. And Calipari has been able to do it in the past. I've been interested to see how last year it fell apart on him. And right now this year, I think this team is better than last year's team. But there's a rut here. And while this year's group is very, very different from last year's group, the continuation from last year is very evident. Right now, you know, Calipari, since he won the title, is under 500 against teams in the KenPom top 100. The only three teams we could reasonably say will make the tournament this year, Kentucky has lost to all three that it's played this year, and last year it went 500 against NCAA tournament teams. So in my opinion, while it's shown flashes, the weird thing is Kentucky really hasn't done anything to prove that it's a top 25 team. Obviously, it's the number one program in the country, but that's kind of a more of a big picture thing. But since the start of last year, like Kentucky just has not shown. Now, I know GP still got him there, and there's a debate to be had, but overall, the results aren't bearing that. They aren't beating the teams that they should beat. And I'm not just talking about like top 25 teams. I'm talking about teams down in the 60s, 70s, and 80s of the KenPom, RPI, Sagarin, whatever you want to say. So it has been interesting to see how Kentucky has failed to do that. I do expect them to turn it around at some point here. I'm just not sure when that happens. And I guess I never thought Calipari would struggle this much with this much talent. I never expected 40-0. That was ridiculous. But I didn't think it would be this much of an issue.
Listen, nobody expected this, right? Some people actually expected 40-0. I didn't. You didn't. But there were like I you know, I don't know what you could. I can just tell you, people would tweet it at me all the time and ask me, "Well, do you think 40-0 is possible?" Every time I'd say, "Yeah, I guess it's possible, but it's statistically unlikely, highly unlikely for all the reasons that I would say it about any team ever in the modern era of college basketball. But you do say it's an interesting debate to have. Let's have it. Here's what I would say in defense of Kentucky. First off, last year's got nothing to do with this year because not only was last year, quote, last year, but it's a completely different roster. So I don't worry about what the Archie Goodwin, Nerlens Noel roster,
Ryan Harrow
roster did as it pertains to this. Undeniably, this year they have been a disappointment relative to the preseason expectations. Like, nobody could argue that. But what is it about losing single-digit games to Michigan State, Baylor, and at North Carolina that proves they don't belong in the top 25? I guess that would be my question. Now, I get it. Let me go ahead and take this one off the table. You know, Toledo right now is undefeated, right? I get into these debates with people. Not debate. I don't know what the hell they are, but like, people ask me questions and I try to answer them. And
Twitter's for some, bad.
Yeah, and for some reason, it's so frustrating because like you can disagree with my logic, but you can't say it's illogical. Like, that's the only thing that bothers me. You can disagree. There's a lot of different ways to do this stuff, but at least I put thought into it at least. So here's what I would say. Once we I do believe the preseason rankings matter, right? They matter as it pertains to everything. For the same reason that Ohio State is 10-0 right now and ranked in the top five in the country. Why is that? Their resume doesn't suggest top five. They have no wins over the top 25. The best wins are win over a Marquette team that's not as good as we thought they it would be. But everybody has Ohio State in the top five. Now, why is that? Because Ohio State started in the top, 10 or 15. Because everybody coming into the season thought Ohio State would be really good. And to date, though Ohio State hasn't played a difficult schedule, Ohio State has done nothing to make you think they're not good. They're undefeated with 10 double-digit wins. Ohio State might prove to be a fraud down the road, but to date, they have not lost a game or done anything to make you think they're not good. On the other end of the spectrum is somebody like, say, Toledo. Toledo's 9-0 right now. Now, they've also played nobody, just like Ohio State played nobody, right? But nobody's ranking Toledo. And so I will get a question, and people don't bring up specifically Toledo. I'm operating at extremes here, but to try to make the same point. So people will ask, okay, well, why, if Ohio State hadn't played anybody, how could you have them in the top five when Toledo is also 9-0? But well, here's why. Because I fundamentally believe that if we think you're supposed to be good, you should be ranked accordingly until you prove otherwise. And if we think you're not supposed to be good, you should be unranked accordingly until you prove otherwise. So Toledo's going to need to get quality wins before anybody takes them seriously, where Ohio State's going to need to take bad losses before anybody doesn't take them seriously, regardless of the lack of quality of wins. So I say all that to ask you again about Kentucky. Okay, they are 8-3. There's no getting around that. The best wins, Providence and Boise State. Nothing great about either one of those. But the losses are to a Baylor team that only has one loss so far, and that's to Syracuse. A Michigan State team that, was preseason number one and is still in the top 10. And a North Carolina team on the road that has beaten the top three teams in the preseason AP poll. And all of those losses are by single digits. None of those losses have been at home. And Kentucky is still performing as a top 15 team, according to KenPom. So I guess I would ask this. Forget what has Kentucky done to prove it's in the top 25. What has Kentucky done to prove it's not? It shouldn't be in the top 25.
Well, I think that, I agree with you because I think we've seen good things. I mean, even though we've been harping on all the bad things that against North Carolina, like it was basically a one or two possession game for most of the second half, and they had a chance to win, and the Harrisons looked good. But so I think that if you compare them to some of the other teams that we've seen, you mentioned Toledo, and I don't see how right now you could say that Toledo is better than Kentucky.
No, like, right. Well, that's not the point. The point is
that anybody's saying that. Yeah.
Yeah, my point on that, and I would take it back to Pittsburgh. My point on that is fundamentally, if I think a team is supposed to be good, I will continue to think that until they prove me otherwise. And if I think a team's not supposed to be good, I will continue to think that until they prove otherwise. In other words, if Alabama in football was ranked number one in the country, and the first 3 weeks of the season they played a bum, a bum, and a bum, and they were 3-0, guess where they would be ranked after 3 weeks of the season?
Of course,
number one. Right. Now, now if let's say Memphis football, which is historically bad, recently bad, perhaps forever bad, started the season unranked because nobody thought they'd be good, and they played the exact three bums that Alabama played and also went 3-0 against them. Where would Memphis football be after 3 weeks of the season?
They'd be Toledo, man.
They would be unranked, unranked. And it wouldn't matter that they've literally played the same schedule as Alabama football. The rankings for Alabama and for Memphis football in that in this hypothetical scenario would be rooted in what we thought they were in the preseason. Alabama is going to be given the benefit of the doubt of being great until they show us they're not. Memphis is not going to be is going to be believed to be bad until they do something significant, notable against a quality opponent to prove that they're better than we thought they were. And so that's how a team like Ohio State right now can be ranked in the top five, and a team like Pittsburgh right now can be unranked. And I don't know why people can't grasp that, but it drives me insane.
I think some people just don't like the notion of preseason polls and
basing December rankings off what you thought back in October.
Right, but there's no other way to do it.
No, I agree. I'm just saying that's what people
think. We're just explaining it. There's a progress to that people don't like. And so, like, who's to say because you thought it before you saw a team play in October, you thought them to be this. Why should that dictate what they are 2 weeks in December? That's the devil's advocate argument.
Okay, good. I got that. That's a reasonable question. Here would be my question back to you, though. Okay, tell me the other way to do it. You really think Toledo should be ranked right now because they're undefeated?
No, people would say the way not to do it is just to let the games play out for six weeks before you have polls, which well, will never, ever happen.
First off, that is the stupidest damn thing I've ever heard. Like, people, I get this every single day, right? God, it'd be great if we didn't have or they should ban polls. Well, who is in charge of ban? We can't ban porn on the internet. How are you going to ban a college basketball poll?
Porn and polls.
What are you talking about? Like, these idiots all the time are tweeting me like, I just wish they would ban polls. We can't ban, we can't ban pornography. We can't ban anything. It's the, if the Associated Press decided tomorrow it was not going to have a college basketball poll, and USA Today decided it was not going to have a coaches poll, we'd still have polls, you know? Like, I'd do one. ESPN would still do one. Like, why do people even have that conversation? Let's talk about that for a minute. Where do people spend even 140 characters trying to suggest the possibility of a world without rankings of some sort?
Listen, I've said before on this podcast, I don't pay much attention to the polls, but there is not anything ever eliminating them because by nature they dictate conversation, broadcasting TV games, marketing for the sport, and I think there is a pushback against them because inherently fans love to rail against the rankings because it gives them something to complain about until, of course, you know, my team's ranked number four, highest ranking they've ever had in 20 years or whatever. So it's silly, but it's just something, it's just inherent to being a college fan to that experience. It's never going away. I mean,
I'm not arguing. If somebody wants to say, hey, listen, I just don't get that involved in the polls. I watch basketball, enjoy basketball. I don't need to hear what a bunch of AP writers or Gary Parrish specifically, I don't need to know how he ranks them or not. That's fine. That's a perfectly reasonable opinion. But I'll tell you this, I posted this updated top 25 and one last night. It hasn't even been up 11 hours. It's got 150 comments. I could write the best column in the history of college basketball right now. It would not get 150 comments. So I get if somebody in particular wants to say, I don't get involved, that's poll. But the idea that there's not an audience for this stuff is just crazy. And beyond that, I don't even care. The point that you would argue that there shouldn't be polls, that's like arguing that there shouldn't be poverty. In theory, like maybe you're right, but good luck, you know, like what?
I guess in that respect, it's the same.
You know what?
Poverty in college basketball.
Poverty in college basketball. Exactly. No, the point is, what is the point of trying to wish and hope for a world where rankings don't exist? Like, if you don't, here's the other thing I'll never understand. If people don't care about rankings, how about just not care about them? I don't spend a minute of my day worrying about something that I yell to the world I don't care about. I got people all over my Twitter feed every single day telling me how much they don't care about rankings. Well, why do you even take the time? Like, I got people every once in a while, they'll tweet about hockey, you know, into my timeline. And I don't take the time to explain to everybody that I don't care about hockey. I mean, I don't care about hockey. So you know what I do? I never think about hockey. I never comment on hockey. If you guys want to have a hockey conversation, you can have it. I just won't get involved in it. It's so baffling to me. People drive me crazy.
Borzello, have you noticed how this podcast has become like something of a bitching hour for Parrish?
He's
venting on everything he likes and doesn't like, doesn't want to do.
People just drive me insane. Oh, God. Like, I can't. I used to only – this is the worst part of like social media. It's like in a different life. You could only be driven crazy by people you lived with or by people you worked with or by, like, your neighbors. Like, there was a very small circle of people who could genuinely drive you insane, right? It'd be like your wife or your girlfriend or your kids or your parents or your – or
now
your
now it's people you never met.
Now we live in a world where people I've never met and will never meet drive me insane. Do you know how awful that is? Do you? And you guys must go through it as well. Don't tell me you don't.
Oh yeah,
and to a certain extent, but I like it though.
I'm not gonna lie.
Borzello, welcome.
It kind of adds a little flavor to my day.
Oh well, like let's be honest, like you know, there's a solution.
You
to
like it,
it
too? Come
yeah.
On.
Oh, I need it. Like I don't just like it. I need it. Like I would be lost without it.
Like if nobody like responded to my
stuff, I'd be like, suicidal.
I'd be like, why aren't you guys hating my stuff? Like,
or why aren't you guys? Yeah, why aren't you guys responding? God, does what
hate
I did?
Things
yeah, no, it's the ultimate compliment that people do take the time to, you know, to, because like I'll see guys all the time, like people I don't know, and they'll say, hey, GP, you know, look, I got college basketball rankings too. Check them out. Well, I almost never check them out because I don't mean to be dismissive.
Like, hey, here's my band. We recorded this tape.
Yeah, right. It's the same thing. Like, I don't mean to be dismissive, like, or whatever. Like, you know, it's sweet that people would send that. But here's what as long as we're speaking honestly, I don't care what you think. I don't care how I don't even know who you are. So why would I care?
You're dreams right now, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Like, I don't care how you
the same people that would send you that are the people dedicated enough to listen to this podcast.
I know. I don't mean it that way. Okay.
You alienated half our listeners.
All right, hold on a second.
Including Goodman.
It's just like Jeff Goodman. He'll send me something. He'll say, "Hey, here's what I think," and I'm like, "Dude, I don't. Why are you operating under the impression that I care what you think about anything?" But
it's the only way you're gonna read it is behind a paywall, man.
Right? I'm like, listen, send me your login, Goodman, and I'll try to. And if I get some time later on today, I'll try to see what you think about something. But here's what I would say. Okay, let me take all that back. Anybody for the next 2 weeks, if you want to send me your rankings, I will look at them. I don't mind. I appreciate that. But it is nice. It is the ultimate compliment that people actually care enough about what I think about anything to argue with me or call me stupid or call me gay or call me whatever it is they call me, right? But I get called all of those things. But it is still like it's weird. I guess that's what I would say. It's just weird to live in a world where you can be called and like randomly called, like criticized all day long. It just beats you down sometimes, you know?
I hear you, man.
Here's the thing. There's no easy way to avoid it, right? I mean, just never look at your mentions. You know, I read a really good article on Skip Bayless. And keep in mind, I'm not trying to pretend I am Skip Bayless or am hated nearly as much as Skip Bayless. But
a man can dream. A man can dream.
I mean, I would love to be. Let me be clear. I would love to be Skip Bayless, right? He's got this thing figured out, all right? So if I could be Skip Bayless one day, that's what I want to be. But
Nickelback one week, Skip Bayless the next.
But here's what podcast. I would say. I'm just saying, like, the idea that, like, Skip Bayless has got this thing figured out. Like, you guys can hate him. He's getting rich just sitting on television and having outlandish opinions. So, like, who's the, you know, meanwhile, I'm ranking basketball teams every morning for a fraction of the salary. So who's smart and who's dumb, right? I admire Skip Bayless on some level. He's got life figured out. But he said, listen, I just don't get involved in the mentions on Twitter. Like, I tweet, and then when I got something else to tweet, I tweet it. But I don't even look at them. And so if you really just didn't want to be susceptible to that, you could just not look at them, but I can't help myself. I need it on some level.
I hear you, man. All right. So what else? What else?
So
far.
All right. Now let me talk to you about my kid. I'm just kidding. All right. Back to basketball. Arizona went to Michigan this weekend. This actually happened early Saturday. I was in Chapel Hill. I watched it on television. I wrote a little bit about it and sort of praising the idea that Sean Miller, thought he would have a good team, and B, scheduled aggressively to try to challenge that team and offer a situation where they could be rewarded. And I recognize that a non-conference schedule has no real effect on postseason success. There's been studies that show that, but they can, a good non-conference schedule that you're successful against can dictate what kind of seed you get in March, and the higher the seed, the better chance you have statistically and historically of advancing in the field of 68. So I just appreciate Sean Miller taking his team on the road to San Diego State, true road game, taking his team on the road to Michigan, true road game. And now they're sitting here undefeated with those wins plus a neutral court over Duke. And whatever gamble or risk, and I really don't think it's much of a risk to challenge your team in basketball. We can talk about that as well. But whatever gamble or risk there was, it's paid off spectacularly for Sean and that program.
Agreed. Absolutely. I love when coaches are willing to do this, guys, because we do have, I think, more coaches than we kind of acknowledge or are willing to see are willing to do this, to go on the road challenge, but it's not as many as I would like. I think it's great for college basketball. I think it's great for students on campus that can particularly go to these games and have something to look forward to in usually December, but sometimes November. Just a good on-campus game between two really good teams. You know, Iowa State, obviously a rivalry that's been going on for decades, offered that on Friday. But when we can have that, it means a lot. Sean Miller's team, I think, benefits from this kind of play. And while you're right, there have been studies, there is no direct correlation between road success, specifically in the non-conference, and getting further in the NCAA tournament. I still believe that it inherently has value. I think that teams can truly grow because you're playing in the most hostile environments normally you're going to see all season. And so when you get to the tournament and it's actually kind of a weirder environment, maybe it's not as pressure packed as it once would be. I really like this Arizona team. They're, to me, by far deserving of the number one ranking in the country. Syracuse kind of has a little bit of a case because of what they've played, and Syracuse has looked pretty good. But man, TJ McConnell, guys, I think he's the best option Miller's had at point guard for what Miller wants to get out of that offense. The Duquesne transfer has been so vital. And Aaron Gordon is a player that's not shooting well. Borzella pointed it out. What's the figure? What was his percent?
12.8 or it's like 16.8%.
Yeah, from two-point range, right?
Hell, yeah, two-point jumpers. Like, not like layups, but like mid-range jumper. He's shooting like 12% or 16% or something like that, which is awful.
So he's not shooting well, but everything else that he's doing has been pretty awesome. Like, he's a very, very good passing forward. Relentless defender, can defend any position on the floor, has been a great rebounder. So
any position, I hate it when people say like that.
I think Aaron Gordon can guard any position in college. Yeah, I think he can guard someone 6'11". I think he can guard someone 6 feet tall. I believe that he can do that. I think he's that good of a defender.
You think he could play, like, if Arizona and Syracuse play for the national title, he could guard Tyler Ennis?
I think if they asked him to, that he could handle that, yes. I think he's that good of a defender. That's just me.
Borzello, help him.
See, all right. First of all, he couldn't guard Tyler Ennis.
It's like when people say.
There's nothing wrong with that. Like, they're not going to ask him to do it. They have one of the best defensive backcourts in the country. But I think the thing about Gordon is, like, he wants to be a small forward. And, you know, in the preseason, we're all like, he can't be a small forward. Like, he can't do this. He can't do that. And, like, he still is showing that he can't do that stuff. But, like, he's had success at playing that three position next to Brandon Ashley and Caleb Tarzewski. And I think the impressive thing is that, you know, he's struggling shooting the ball and getting his own shot and things like that, but he's still finding so many ways to contribute, and he's not kind of, you know, forcing things. I'm super impressed by everything he's done. You know, once that jump shot comes around, and I think it will, he's shown in high school that he can make jump shots. And I do think his best position is at the four, but if he wants to play the three, and he keeps contributing defensively, rebounding, passing. You know, Arizona's, I love them. I think they're defensively, they're the best team in the country. I just think they can match up with pretty much anybody. And we've seen that. You know, they shut down, you know, Glenn Robinson in the second half. They shut down Jabari Parker for 10, 12-minute stretches. So, you know, they're a scary team. And it could beat you at any position.
I think Arizona's terrific. And Norlander made the point that, you know, winning on the road in the non-conference doesn't or not winning on the road in the non-conference doesn't dictate March success. I agree with that, but tell me if you would agree with this. This has always been my general statement. I think I wrote about this you know, 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the Brandon Knight Kentucky team that went to the Final Four, but like was 7-6 in the SEC at one point with zero quality road wins, right? They could not beat anybody on the road. And I remember saying something along these lines to somebody at some point that I don't think if you lose road games, I don't think that necessarily means you're bad. Like, I get bad teams lose road games. I got that. But just because you are, because Kentucky was stacking road losses, and I kept trying to say, listen, Kentucky may not be great, but don't base it off of the idea that they're losing road games, because you can be great without losing road games. And you can be great while losing road games. And I think we saw it that year. That team ended up in the Final Four, lost to Connecticut in the national semifinals. I say that to say this: if you do win road games, like significant road games at places like San Diego State and Michigan, like, I think that means you are great. In other words, if you lose them, it doesn't mean that you're not. But if you win them, I think it suggests that you've got something special, particularly if you can go get two of those, you know, before December 16th.
I think the thing about those road games that you kind of mentioned, it's basically a win-win situation.
Yes.
If you lose them, it's not a big deal because you're on the road against a really good team. And, you know, you're still growing as a team as long as you don't lose by 40. But and if you win, it's a humongous win. So I don't understand why more teams don't do it. It's basically a no lose situation.
I don't understand why people don't do it either. Real quick question for you guys. Michigan is 6-4. There was variance in what people expected. Some thought they'd be a preseason top 10. Others thought maybe fringe top 25. But regardless, 4-loss team, 7 points to Iowa State. That 2-point loss was kind of a bad one to Charlotte. 10-point loss to Duke, and then a 2-point home loss to Arizona. How good or bad do we think Michigan is? It's, you know, it's got two road losses, a neutral and a home, and its best win is over Florida State in overtime. Yeah. At that exempt.
I think Michigan, first, let's start here. They're not as good as people thought, right? Like, if you had them in the top 10 preseason, I think they were in the top 10 preseason. Like, they're not that good. They're not a top 10 team. I think they are. That said, the record is a little bit like Kentucky's. You know, they're a product of their schedule. They're a product of their schedule. Like, if you give the same schedule to another borderline top 25 team, and I think that's what we're going to find out Michigan is at the end of the day. They're like a borderline top 25 team. They're an NCAA tournament team, like a top 25-ish team. 25 to 40, somewhere in there. Or 20 to 40, somewhere
in there. Like a 7 seed.
I agree.
Yeah, that's what they're going to be, right? Yeah. Okay. So if you take any other team like that, like, who's ranked at the bottom of the top 25? Like Missouri. If you take Missouri and give them Michigan's schedule to date, which is, you know, a home game against Arizona and a road game at Duke and whatever else, like, they'd probably
Iowa State.
Okay, this is perfect. This actually shakes out perfectly. Okay, so you get Missouri 9-0, whatever, they're ranked 10-0 right now. They're undefeated. They've got a bunch of nothing games, and then the home win over at UCLA. So it's fine. Like, Frank Hayes doing a great job, whatever. But if you take Michigan's schedule and give it to Missouri, where is Missouri right now? Probably get the win over Charlotte.
Probably beat Charlotte and lose
the other ones, right? Yeah.
Most likely, yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's where – so my opinion of Michigan has changed, right? Because I thought I had them preseason top 10. This stuff's all documented, so I'm not going to come on here and on December 16th and pretend, oh, I knew Michigan was going to suck. I had them preseason top 10. I expected them to be better. So they've been disappointment relative to what I thought they'd be. But they're still top 25-ish team. Like, they're not going to be bad and go to the – I'd be surprised if they're in the NIT, I tell you that.
Yeah, I agree.
They're an NCAA tournament team. I don't think – like you said, I mean, they're not as good as we thought, and I think they have some humongous problems offensively in terms of guys that are really, really missing Trey Burke, Mitch McGarry. Glenn Robinson had a really good first half, but in the second half he kind of got shut down. And I think it's going to come down to what Derek Walton does at point guard. I mean, they use Spike Albrecht. And he's terrific on CBS, at least. And he can't be their Big Ten title winning point guard. Like, it's got to be Derek Walton. He only played 15 minutes against Arizona. He has to be the guy that gets him into offense and makes shots and gets open shots for Glenn Robinson III and Stauskas and McGarry. And so I think what they do come March is going to depend on what Derek Walton becomes.
Let me ask you guys something. You mentioned Tyler Ennis a minute ago, Norlander, and he had a really nice game yesterday. I think he had 15 points in the first half, finished with like 21. He's been really good For Syracuse. Joel Embiid had another impressive performance, at least in spurts, on Saturday. And I was going back through the recruiting rankings. Borzello, help me out here. Why were Ennis and Embiid ranked so low? And again, they're both consensus top 25 recruits, but like at 247 Sports, Embiid was 14th and Tyler Ennis was 23rd. At Scout.com, Ennis was 22nd, Embiid was 23rd. I didn't see these guys as in high school as much as you saw.
Embiid, like, he didn't, nobody saw him for the most part until the summer before his senior year. And then he went to the Rock School, I think that's what it's called, down in Florida. So not a lot of people saw him until
the Rocks.
I think it's something. I think it's.
I'm picturing the wrestler like.
God, I wish I would have gone to the Rock School.
Yeah, I think that's what it's called. But so, like, a lot of people didn't see him, and you know, they saw him in maybe late in his high school season, and it was only one time. So I think that affected him. For Tyler Ennis, he was on the scene for so long, and you know, he was looked at as basically like a solid point guard. I mean, he played alongside Wiggins and Rayson Mays on AAU, so he was looked at as kind of a facilitator for them. And I don't know if anybody saw him as a, you know, a guy that can come in and be one of the five best freshmen in the country. In terms of importance, everyone thought that, but I don't think a lot of people saw him as an immediate star point guard in college basketball.
See, I saw Ennis a lot for the reasons that you just mentioned. He played with Andrew Wiggins, right?
Yes.
And so I went to see Andrew Wiggins a lot, and so I saw Tyler Ennis a lot. And I just remember thinking he was great. Like
I think
GP is like, I was ahead of everybody.
No, but like, no, listen,
like, he's like a top 25-30 recruit.
Yeah, like
it, no question. But.
Like if you asked me like that, well, would you have ranked him in the top five after you saw him? Probably not, right? I'd have had Wiggins and Randall and Gordon, and it would have looked a lot like everybody else's, Jabari. But 20, like if you would have said, do you think he's 22? I would have said, got to be higher than that, right? I just remember always liking him. I don't know. I just remember
like you
that.
But you compare him to the guys that were ahead of him at point guard. It was like Casey Hill, who's like freakishly fast and long. And then Andrew Harrison, who's 6'5", gets over him whenever he wants. And then like you look at Terry Rozier and Cat Barber. You know, so these guys are like either freakishly fast, really athletic, great defenders. Like Ennis just does everything really solid. And so he didn't, I don't think he had that, you know, one key talent that set him apart from the guys that he was fighting for 3, 4, 5 at point guard.
Listen, Ennis has been awesome. I do think you can make the case he's been as valuable as any freshman this year.
Sure.
I'm very interested to see what Borzello's freshman watch comes out on Tuesday, where he falls and just a general picture, because Embiid, Ennis, that makes 6 impact. You could say Vonley from Indiana. I mean, guys, it's just we kind of hit on it every week, but it's worth talking about just because these freshmen are continually
so much
impact.
Every week, it's like you look at Jordan Mickey at LSU. He's getting no attention. Yes. He's averaging like 14, 10,
listen,
and 5 blocks. Like, it's ridiculous.
I tweeted about him when I was down. I saw him at the Old Spice, right, down in Orlando a few weeks ago. And I remember I went down to SEC Media Days, and I was doing – like I was working for CBS Sports Network those 2 days. And essentially, I had my own room, and they were funneling in the coaches to me for sit-down television interviews that were anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes each, right? So I just sit in a chair, and they go, here's Billy Donovan. And then they go, here's John Calipari. And they bring them all to me. And Johnny Jones came in, and he's the coach at LSU. And you know, we're just shooting the whatever while they're setting up the lighting or whatever, because I'm supposed to be asking, I'm there to ask very specific questions for television packages. It's not necessarily what I want to know. It's what some producer in New York wants to know. But Johnny sits down and they're fixing lighting, and we've got a couple minutes to just shoot the whatever. And I said, so how's Jarrell Martin been? Cause he's like the heralded recruit that Johnny enrolled at LSU. And he said, oh, Jarrell's great. He's going to be great and whatever. But then he immediately said, but Jordan Mickey, like, you got to see this kid. Have you ever seen Mickey? I said, I've seen him, but not, you know, briefly and whatever. He said, Mickey is ready to go. Like, Jordan Mickey's going to be really good. And I just, as I've watched him develop throughout the season, I guess I don't want to speak for Johnny, but my indication after talking to Johnny very briefly back in October was that they might have expected Mickey to be better than Martin, and so far he has been better than Martin.
Huh. I think LSU's problem is that they just have been out of the discussion for so long that they kind of need a Tuesday night win on ESPN over Kentucky. Like, they just need one of those big time wins to kind of put them on the map, because you're absolutely right, and his reputation, I think, among scouts has been pretty damn awesome as well. And that's actually not to get too deep into LSU hoops, but that's considered one of the better jobs, relatively speaking. Like, the amount of talent that state produces, it's almost something of a sleeping giant, so to speak, in college basketball. So I've long wanted LSU to kind of get back in the national conversation. They flirted back in 06, 07 when they were pretty good and making a Final Four, but it's been a long time coming for that program.
No, I think that LSU team, this LSU team, might end up being the third best team in the SEC. Right now, yeah. You know, they only got two losses right now. They're 6-2. They got two losses. One of them was at UMass on, you know, opening, you know, or the first week, right, of the season.
And Martin was out for most of that game, yeah.
Went down the first minute of, right, the game, yeah, right? And so you go at you look at it at the time, and you go, lost to you. But now losing at UMass, like, UMass is good, right? We know UMass is good. So
everyone's lost to UMass.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they were they led Memphis for most of the game on a neutral court. And then Memphis, you know, Austin Nichols got going really late in that game, and Memphis pulled away. But the only two losses are two teams that are ranked in the top 25 right now. They've got a win over a Butler team that seems okay. Not great, but yeah, okay. Like, I think LSU is going to be really good. That's my point. Let me ask you about something else, because we did a pretty good job last Monday of talking my way through a column that I was planning to write, the Scott
You're
Drew.
For that.
Hey, I wondered if I could do it. It worked, didn't it? It worked.
It worked quite well, man. You were locked and loaded for that column, man.
Love that Scott Drew Nickelback column. I thought it worked. Okay, so here's I was just thinking last night. I was looking at the rankings, and so right now the top four teams, I don't know about the AP poll. It's not, hasn't been released yet, but at least in the top 25 and one, the top four teams, for whatever it's worth, are Arizona, Ohio State, Syracuse, and Wisconsin. The one thing that they all have in common is, I don't want to say great point guards, although I think Ennis is great, but they all have, like, reliable point guards, like really, like, safe. You seem to know what you're getting. Point guards. When we're talking about McConnell and Kraft and Tyler Ennis, and then at Wisconsin, you got a couple of guys who can handle the ball. I wonder if you guys think there's anything to that, the value early of not getting sporadic point guard play, of being really consistent at that position.
I think so. I remember back in right before the season, me and Gottlieb did this thing where we went through, like, I think the top 12 teams, and we looked at, like, their biggest question mark heading into the year, or, you know, kind of their fatal flaw or whatever. And for a lot of those teams, it was consistency at the point guard spot. And that's what a lot of these teams need. Like, Louisville need Chris Jones to be consistent. Andrew Harrison has to be consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, you go down the line, and, you know, Nadir Tharp. It's all these guys. And then the four teams that we've talked about, they're getting fine. Like, they're not getting superstar play. They're getting really solid play. You know, not a lot of turnovers, getting the ball to the right people, scoring when needed. Like, it's. I think you're onto something, because, you know, you look at the star point guards, or the teams that have a lot of talent, they need a consistent point guard play, and the teams at the top, they're getting solid, consistent point guard play.
I think we can also look at Syracuse specifically, and it's almost become a mini point guard U here. It's basically been since Eric Devendorf that, yeah, Jim Boeheim hasn't had a reliable and talented collegiate slash pro prospect option at point guard.
I don't know.
Hold on. I'm not saying.
Okay, go ahead.
You had Johnny Flynn, who was highly drafted,
sure,
successful in college.
Yeah.
Okay, then you had Scoop, who was.
People didn't love Scoop. That's the word. That's where you fall apart.
I know, people kind of, but he was good
fine
option at point guard.
Was he drove people, okay, nuts? He drove people,
yeah,
nuts.
He did. I always thought he was. He did.
I actually think he's the opposite of reliable, isn't he?
He's the guy that if I was writing about fatal flaws for teams, I would say they need consistent point guard play from Scoop.
I like Scoop more than a lot of people. But then you had Carter Williams,
yes,
and then you have Ennis
this
year. And now Syracuse is 10-0 to start the season for the fifth straight year. Syracuse haters will be like, they never play anyone. I get that. This year they actually have.
Sure they have. Syracuse deserves whatever they're getting right now. I mean, that's a good basketball team, and they've beaten good people.
Right, right. So what I'm getting at here is maybe, you know, Boeheim doesn't get a lot of credit, or at least he isn't noticed a lot for the kind of guards that he is able to bring in. You kind of get talk every season or every other season about the big men and what they can do, or the wings. You know, we had Wes Johnson a few years ago, but the guard play has been pretty pretty great. And I don't know. I'm kind of marveled that Boeheim is this awesome yet again. Like, I think about 2 years ago, like where we were and what he's been able to do, the teams he's been able to put on the floor. He's had what, the past five seasons, 3 seed, 1 seed, 3 seed, 1 seed, 4 seed, 31 team last year. And yeah, he was off to a 10-0 start. So yes, I think the point guard play is huge. I think it's definitely a factor. And I think, you know, sometimes you have cliches and stereotypes because they're for a reason. And I've always thought the point guard play means a lot in college basketball. And I think now more than ever, when the game is faster than ever and it's becoming smarter than ever, do you need capable guys running the one?
It is interesting that just a few years ago, well, you know, I wrote about this earlier in the year, there's actually five Hall of Fame coaches in college basketball right now. And I don't mean future Hall of Fame, like Bill Self's future Hall of Fame or Billy Donovan's future Hall of Fame. I mean already in the Hall of Fame. That's the thing I don't know people realize, all people realize about the Basketball Hall of Fame is you could still be working and be in the Basketball Hall of Fame. So the coaches are Mike Krzyzewski, Roy Williams, Rick Pitino, Jim Boeheim, and Larry Brown, actually. Those are the five. And so I wrote about the four, you know, the four guys who are at like premier top tier programs, which would be everybody except for Larry Brown. And it is remarkable to think that Boeheim and Pitino, if you go back just a couple of years, as you noted a minute ago, like we, for different reasons, we didn't know if they were going to be able to keep their jobs, right? Okay. For off the court, different stuff. But they are still, even at advanced age, at advanced ages, operating at such a high level, which is, you know, like we see Mac Brown get the 62 at Texas and it starts to slip on him, right? We see Bobby Bowden get to an advanced age and it slipped on him. We see Joe Paterno get to an advanced age and it slipped on him. But it has not slipped on, well, you can even add Roy and Kay back into this conversation now. We've got guys in their 60s who are, you know, Hall of Famers, legends, icons, but there's no... Like in football, we've seen the examples where you get into these sort of delicate, touchy conversations about how do you transition out of the Bobby Bowden era or the Paterno era or the Mac Brown era. And nobody is trying to transition out of the K era or the Roy era or Boeheim era or Pitino era. It's pretty I don't know if it's rare, but it seems rare.
And like if you look at – I mean in college football recruiting, opponents could have kind of picked on those coaches, be like, well, you know, he's not going to be there all 4 years that you're there. Like what are they going to say if – a kid's considering Duke or UNC, like, oh yeah, don't go join Jabari Parker and all those kids. Like, don't go play with Jahlil Okafor. K might not be there. Like, you can't even say that. Like, these guys are going to be there and win 30 games as long as they want to. And it's so different than what college football seemed like when those guys were in it.
Doesn't even seem like college basketball used to be like this, though, like 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't feel like there were 67-year-old coaches that were, like, running game on the nation like they are.
Running game.
There. Running game, man. Like, Coach K, that's a badass mofo right there.
and listen, I think Roy gets his credit, although some people dismiss him in certain circles. I mean, he's got two national championships, and he's been, terrific at two different programs. I think for the most part, Roy gets his – and Pitino is obviously considered one of the great coaches of all time, period. K is widely considered as possibly the best of all time, right up there with Wooden and Bobby Knight. I mean, that conversation gets had. I think Boeheim is the one out of the group of four that probably is not properly appreciated. And yet, he's like, I don't remember who was on what side of the argument, but there was a moment last year during the season on CBS, like halftime, where Doug Gottlieb and Seth Davis, the name of Jim Boeheim came up, and I don't remember who was on what side.
But Gottlieb was on the anti-Boeheim side.
I was purposely being vague. I honestly didn't remember. But I just remembered one of them sort of saying, hey, Jim Boeheim's not great.
And he said Jim Boeheim's not a Hall of Famer, I'm almost positive.
Well, like he is like
or like he wasn't
he's,
deserving.
He's,
like he was
literally
like that,
a Hall of Famer. That's not even debatable.
Like or no. I apologize. I don't want to slander Doug. He said he was not an all time top 10 coach. I believe is what he said.
Yeah,
he was approaching. He was approaching being like number two, number three all time in wins, and that's what they were talking about.
Jim Boeheim is unbelievable. Like, did you know how difficult it is?
Have you ever been to Syracuse?
Yes, it is so cold and just, I'm not going to rip it. Like, I live in Memphis, so people are constantly ripping on Memphis. Like, you're going to get
negative
robbed.
You're recruiting Syracuse right now.
Yeah, you're going to get robbed and you're going to get dangerous and the school systems suck. And it's all of that stuff is true to some degree. But I can't very well be the guy, like, ripping on other cities. But yes, I've been to Syracuse, so I know the point that you're making.
Yeah, well, I'm just rhetorical. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So do you know how difficult it is to be awesome at something for 3 decades consistently with almost no lapses, like with almost no downturns? I mean, I understand there's been like a, you know, NIT here and there and that kind of stuff. But for the most part, he has been consistently awesome forever. Like I just don't know how that – I don't know why he isn't appreciated more than he's appreciated.
Because he plays 2-3 zone.
Is that it? I mean, I really don't know why.
I think so, mate. I mean, like –
lame if that's the case.
If that's the case, it's dumb.
I think people look at his acumen as a coach maybe a little less than they look at other people because he plays zone.
Let me ask you, Norlander, how many spots – okay, so like in terms of active coaches, you'd go Krzyzewski probably one up there. You'd go – I know you – where would you put – how many spots behind Rick Bird would you put Jhumae Hines?
Dude, I knew before you even asked the question. Before you even asked it, I knew what was coming out of the barrel.
I'm not asking you where would Boeheim be. I'm asking you how far behind Rick Bird would you have Jim Boeheim? I love Rick Bird. I hate that it gets twisted.
Before we wrap up, can we just quickly talk Homeland?
We are going to talk Homeland. I've got it right here in my notes. Norlander, let me get you there. I'll get you there.
We had to hit Rick Bird first.
Had to hit Rick Bird. I had to rant for 20 minutes about people on Twitter. We will get to the Homeland.
I'm just making sure, man.
Even worry about it. Okay, first, before we get to Homeland, tomorrow night is the Jimmy V. I mentioned that up top. Which are both of you guys going? Which you guys going?
No, I'll be there.
I'm going to Duke UCLA at the Garden on Thursday.
Oh, I'm off the road. I've been grounded since I got home from Chapel Hill.
I know. You just let us know when we can talk about that thing, and we will.
Oh no! It's no. Like we have our second child on the way, right? And
there
so,
congrats, Harry.
Thank you.
Podcast announcement. There we go. Congrats, man. A couple of weeks now here.
Yeah, we're very excited. And like just ready. You know, anybody who's ever had a child knows that by the time you get to, you know, you're 2 weeks from the due date, you want it. You're like, come on, man, get like, let's go. Like she's miserable, right? She can't sleep. She can't move. Like she just, you know, just hates everything at this point. So we're ready to go, but like I can't risk not being here for, you know, so like I'm not going to Jimmy V. I'm probably not going to Kentucky Louisville, you know, which is weird. Yeah. Because you know, the due date, I don't want to get specific because she doesn't want me to, but the due date's after Kentucky Louisville, and so unless the baby comes unexpectedly before then, I'm grounded for a little while. So you guys are going to be the on the road for CBSSports.com. So Jimmy V, Florida, Memphis. Who you got, Borzello?
I got Florida. Chris Walker probably won't play. I was kind of hoping to see him. Right. But I had Florida in the Final Four in the preseason. I think we saw against Kansas what they can be when they actually have more than 5 or 6 players. So I like them. I think Memphis is they're fine. I think they're going to be a top 3 or 4 seed in March. I just think Florida's a better team.
I think that's fair. I think it's going to be probably a 1-point, 2-point spread for Florida.
Game,
you know, they're like I don't know if it'll be a close game. I'm saying the point spread is going to be like Florida -1, Florida -2, Florida -3. It'll be like a one possession point spread, but I think Florida's better, particularly if Florida's healthy. I think Florida's probably better, but it'll be interesting. And then UCLA, Duke later on this week at the Garden. That's interesting because I think we've. Listen, you come into the year, you start talking about freshmen. Everybody was talking about Jabari Parker along with the other guys, but Jabari was in that conversation. Suddenly, Zach LaVine has joined that conversation. Borzello, back to recruiting. You're our recruiting guy. Like, explain to me Zach LaVine.
Well, first of all, he was a West Coast kid, and West Coast kids are notoriously underrated for the most part because they always have a stigma of being soft or can't do this or can't do that. But he was always a freak athlete. And people are clearly seeing that he's had a ton of dunk highlights, but he was like a top, you know, I think one place had him as a 5-star kid. He's like a top 50 kid. So it's not like he's coming out of nowhere. But I think not many people expect him to average 15 a game off the bat. He's scoring a lot of different ways. Like he's in transition, he's hitting shots. And, I think he's going to be a huge piece, for UCLA, going forward. He kind of adds a different dimension that they don't have a ton of explosive weapons. And I think he kind of gives them another guy besides Jordan Adams and Kyle Anderson.
Did he commit to Ben Hallen or after that?
He committed in June of 2012.
Okay.
So that was before last season.
Okay, yeah. So I just remember when I went to LA like last February or whenever it was, maybe late January, and I wrote that column about Ben Hallen, sort of like, you know, he's having success, he's recruiting well, he's playing fast, and yet still people are speculating about his job. And we went on this long walk. I hope you remember the column. We went on this long walk in Santa Monica, like a 3 mile.
I remember your long walk.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. I
could not forget the long walk column, yeah.
Hey, that column worked too.
I know,
by
it's
the
just,
way.
It's just like
The way
you set the scene was so romantic.
It was romantic, right? So it's Ben Hallen. It's Ben Hallen and I walking through Santa Monica, like down by the ocean, just sort of enjoying the scene. But also, we talked, like we walked 3 miles. We had a long time to talk, and we was talking about while recognizing that whether he would be able to keep his job was very much up in the air. It looked like at that point, which is sort of why I wrote the column, and I think he knew this at this point that they wanted to fire him. They were looking for any reason to do it, so he knew he was fighting an uphill battle. But when he was talking about the possibility of next year, he was going, listen, we're going to lose Shabazz, so that's, you know, whatever, we'll lose him. But bring back Kyle Anderson, play him at the point, bring back Jordan Adams. You know, the Wares are back. Who's my big kid? Tony Parker.
Bring
Tony Parker back, should be better. And he said, then we got this kid named, you know, Zach LaVine, who I think is going to be really good. And you throw him out there with them, and he's like, I got a top 15 team again. You know, if I just get to come back and coach him, like, I'm going to be good again. And I remember going, okay, I don't remember seeing Zach LaVine, and he wasn't like a consensus top 10 guy or 15 guy. But I just remember that conversation about how he was really excited about the possibility of Zach LaVine. And it reminded me one time when I was also out in LA many years ago, and we were talking about, I don't remember exactly how it lined up. Maybe it was the year after they lost Aflalo and who else was on?
Collison, Darren Collison.
No, I think it was before that. It was Aflalo, Jordan Farmar, maybe.
Yeah,
there was a year
that,
where UCLA lost some guys, and they lost at least one guy.
Was it when they lost to Florida in the title game?
No, I don't remember the date. I just remember having this conversation. I'm sitting with Kerry Keating and Ben Hallen, and like we're having dinner somewhere. And I'm like, so how do you replace? We're talking about his team, and it's during football season. I was out there for a football game, I think, right? Like a UCLA Notre Dame football game.
Flalo did, yeah. Okay,
I don't remember what it was. I don't remember the time. I just remember this conversation. I said, so what do you do now at this particular position? You know, you lost this guy early. What do you do now at this? And he said, Russell Westbrook. And I said, Russell Westbrook. And he said, Russell Westbrook is going to be awesome. And I was like, okay, like whatever. And you never know if like a coach just, like, it thinks somebody's going to be awesome because they need to think that. But I just remember there was no actual evidence that Russell Westbrook was going to be awesome. And then he was awesome. And now he is awesome. And I'm not saying Zach LaVine is Russell Westbrook. I think that's probably a lazy comparison. But the point is that Ben Hallen talked about Zach LaVine in the same way that he talked about Russell Westbrook in, you haven't seen this guy enough, but trust me, he's going to be really good. And to date, that looks to be true with LaVine. He's been really, really not just good, but exciting, like fun to watch, you know?
Yeah, and just a quick note on UCLA. I mean, they're a 9-1 team. The only good team they played, Missouri, they lost to. It was on the road. Their best win is against Drexel. So this is
sure.
I don't expect them to win. If they lose, doesn't mean they're terrible. If they win, it'll be one of those Arizona type situations where you beat Duke even on a neutral. The Cameron Square Garden, as some
right,
people
Duke,
like to,
MSG is like Duke's second home.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, exactly. So you beat Duke in MSG, that would really go a long way for Alford this early, because I was one of the many who thought Alford at UCLA was a decent hire, but I still think long term, like, I don't think Alford's going to be there in 7 years. That's just my opinion. But in the here and the now, you get that win. On Thursday, there's not a lot of games going on this week. You know, national TV, ESPN. That would be a boon to UCLA if they can get a win over Duke. And by the way, if Duke loses that, it'll be interesting to see what the conversation happens. Then they'll be 7-3. They'll have their win over Michigan, who's a little down. I'm very intrigued by the game and excited to see LaVine in person, and of course Jabari, who's just ridiculous.
Well, remember at UCLA, even if you go to three Final Fours, you only get 10 I years. Know. You only get 10 if you go to three exactly. Final Fours. So good luck trying to get to seven. Right. All right, let's wrap this thing up. We've been going about an hour now. Let me say this. If you watch Homeland and you care about Homeland and you haven't seen the season 3 finale yet, you can go ahead and click the stop button now. I appreciate you being here. We were done with basketball, but I did promise Norlander last week that we would talk the Homeland season finale. So let me ask you this, Norlander. What do you think?
Okay, so here's my take on it. I don't know. For me, I have been actually rooting for the show. For as amazing as an actor and character as he is, I actually think in some ways Homeland is held back by relying so much on Brody to be the catalyst for all things terrorism, anti-terrorism related. So I was actually rooting for Brody to be killed, basically since mid-season 2, because he was so awesome in season 1. So I'm a fan of them getting rid of him. But I actually, there was something, like, last night didn't feel like a finale. Except for his death, it didn't have that urgency. And now I'm very...
It felt like a series finale.
I'm ambivalent, exactly, because I'm ambivalent on where we go here, like, with Berenson, with Saul now, the beard.
He seems done.
Like, no, he's got to be. He's a great character. He'll be back.
He's my favorite character. I love what he does. I do have hope because I've always felt like... I've liked how Homeland has kind of kept it realistic in terms of the tension.
Hold on, stop. There is nothing realistic about Homeland. All right, there's nothing realistic about it.
The thing about having no more Brody is like the first whatever 5 episodes of this season they didn't have Brody and they were terrible. Like it was all.
But no, it was. But it wasn't terrible because they didn't have Brody. Fair. It was just terrible because it was terrible.
Because it had Dana. I just have no clue. Like there was no real cliffhanger. I guess the cliffhanger is that we don't know any direction the show goes in.
No, there is no cliffhanger. Here's what I would say. I think Borzello, you're exactly right. It felt more like a series finale than a season finale, because typically, with these types of shows, the season finale, like, it's going to leave you going, "Oh my God, I can't wait till it restarts," because we got to see what happened, right? Like I'm watching Scandal now. I'm getting caught up on Scandal. And
dude,
so I know, like, I really like God. It. I really like it. So, but at the end of season 1, it was like, okay, we've got to see who Quinn Perkins is. Like, what is going, like, oh God, I can't wait for this to come back for season 2, because I got to know who this girl is. Like, she's some sort of like a mystery, and like that's the cliffhanger. Who is this person? And then you got all the other subplots, but that was like, it left you like wanting something. Last night, they didn't leave you wanting anything. Like, oh, Carrie's going to Istanbul. Like,
she made that stupid doodle on the wall.
Right. It felt way more like a series finale. Like, it was trying to wrap everything up. Brody's dead. Carrie is moving on to start a new life, probably without her unborn child. Saul's going to live, with his wife, wherever it is he's going to live, be a civilian. And like, it could, like, the series could end right there, and it would be like, okay, that's a reasonable place for the series to end.
3 seasons, good job.
Yeah. That said, so it was weird in that respect. That said, Brody had to die, because with Brody living, too much of the story, I think, was tied up in this awkward relationship between Carrie and Brody.
Yeah,
which I never was a fan of.
Well, here's the problem with that relationship.
Their dialogue scenes were brutal.
Yes,
like, it took like 12 minutes a scene.
Here's the problem when you have sort of these forbidden relationships. Like, and this happens in a lot of different shows. You have two people who maybe want to be together, but for whatever reason they can't be together, right? So like in sitcoms, there was like The Office with Jim and Pam, right? So Pam's got a fiance, and there's this chemistry between Jim and Pam, but how do you approach it, and what do you do? And but the audience, I think, was always rooting for Jim and Pam, right? Because you go, God, they should be together. Like, I don't care that Pam's engaged to somebody else. Like, she needs to get rid of that guy, and Jim needs to move in, and Jim and Pam need to be together. So that could be a storyline for The Office, because it was a storyline that you were always rooting for. I think on Scandal, I don't know where it's going. I'm still like, I've got a few episodes left in season 2, so don't ruin it for me. So I don't know where it's going. But like, this forbidden relationship between Fitz and Olivia is like forbidden for all the obvious reasons. Like, Fitz is married with children, and he's president of the United States, and blah, blah, blah. But people, I think, I still think the dynamic between those two is still sort of the most important part of that show. Like, all of the suspense and mystery and political drama and blah, 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 like, that matters. That keeps the story moving. But at its heart, it's still, at least to the point where I'm at right now in the series, I don't know where it goes from here, but where I'm at right now, still the heart of the show is this awkward dynamic between Fitz and Olivia, because though I think, listen, everybody can look at that and go, whoa, like, they're both, you know, flawed, seriously flawed characters who have done some things that they shouldn't have done. You still sort of go, God, but maybe they should be together. Like, he really cares about her and she really cares about him. And I think a lot of people have sort of can root for that, even though maybe it's not the way that that those types of things ought to go. I think people can sit back and kind of root for that relationship because you see Fitz maybe in a marriage that he shouldn't be in, and Olivia seems to genuinely care about Fitz, and Fitz seems to genuinely care about Olivia. And so you can sort of root for that. I say all that to say, who was rooting for Carrie and Brody's forbidden relationship? Like, I don't get this. I don't get the sense that anybody was going, God,
we need another scene between them.
Or Pam, like, you could go, okay, Pam's engaged to whatever that dude's name was, but Pam and Jim need to be together. I'm rooting for that. Or Fitz is married to Melly, but Olivia and Fitz, they are meant to be together. Those two, like, I'm rooting for that. Because those circumstances dictate or are preventing them from being together. God, sometimes you just find somebody in life that's perfect for you, or that you really click with, and a lot of people, I think, can relate to that. And so you go, okay, I'm rooting for Olivia and Fitz's forbidden relationship. So then Carrie and Brody have a forbidden relationship, but I don't know who's rooting for that. Like, who wanted them to be together? It was just so weird. Like, because at the end of the day, like, Brody is like, he's a murderer. You know, like, it's a murderer terrorist. Like, nobody really wanted, nobody was rooting for that forbidden. So I'm glad Brody's gone, if for no other reason than that dynamic is gone. Does that make sense?
It does. And I just think that in order for Homeland to move forward and have, and I use this with air quotes, realistic plot lines and hurdles in terms of international terrorism, you couldn't have it continually centered around Brody, because that would not, I mean, it just, it would have gotten so out of hand and ridiculous.
If they kept Brody, what would they have done?
Exactly.
Like,
what do you do then?
Escape from Iran. Although, and then have him kill somebody else. All right,
like, one other, like, real quick thing. I mean, Showtime is downright notorious for dragging series out. Like, Dexter was four seasons too long.
God.
I mean, it's just notorious. And you notice it with, what's the vampire show? I'm blanking. True Blood. True Blood.
Well, that's HBO.
Oh, that's HBO? Well, then my bad. But regardless, I just worry now. Like, I hope it's good, but I wish that they would know when to pull the plug. Maybe
you know what you
one
do?
Or two
Here's
more
what
seasons.
I think they do now, and I think it'll be fine. Like, there's nothing to look forward to right now, because you just it's basically going to be a reboot of a series, right? It's going to have the same name and some of the same characters, but if you go back to this season, like, when it was really getting good, like, when you went, oh wow, Homeland's back on track, like, you'd see those tweets, right? Like, because it got off to a sort of a slow start with Dana and rehab and, like, all this weird, like, stuff.
And by the way, they're not coming back.
Yeah, like, know. I'm gonna miss
I know you're a little depressed about that.
I'm gonna miss Jessica Brody so much, but so you wasted a lot of time, and maybe it's just because you got to get through so many so many different episodes, but they wasted a lot of time on this Dana story that just doesn't, there's no reason to think it matters anymore, you know? Like, it's like, who cares what happens to Dana Brody? Like, who cares that she almost tried to commit suicide and might do it again and changed her name? Like, none of that matters to the storyline seemingly going forward. So still, we had to deal with that through the first few episodes. But there was a moment in this season where people were like, oh, Homeland's back on track. And here's what I would say. It had nothing to do with Brody. It was about Saul and about Carrie and
CIA,
the CIA. And it had nothing to do with Brody. Brody was brought into that storyline, but Brody was not the reason people started going, oh wow, Homeland's back. It was all these seemingly interesting storylines, within under the umbrella of the CIA and Carrie and Saul. And I think you can easily get that back. You know, there's
I think the one good thing about Brody, like, they have no ties to anything now. They don't have, like as you said, it's a complete reboot. Like, they left the one opening was, okay, there's something urgent happening. Carrie, you got to come to room 4 before she graffitied the CIA walls. But, so, like, they have several months to come up with, like, some awesome new plot line. That's like literally the only thing we were left with. There's nothing else that we could say, okay, they got to clean this up. They got to wrap this up. They start fresh. And I think that's the one good thing.
Yeah, I think they'll start. And you know what it'll be like? It won't be like this. But like, remember when 24, like that was a wildly popular.
Is that coming back?
I don't
know. It is.
Is it? Is it? I have no idea. Okay, so
it's got one season, yeah.
Like I skipped out on it after like four or five seasons. I was just like, I was over it, right? But like the first few seasons, they were like really good. Like or not, I don't know if they were good. They were fun. Like they kept you interesting.
They were good, yeah, they were fun.
Okay, so like what they would do every season is just create this brand new interesting storyline, right? And I think Homeland can easily do that. You give me Carrie, give me Saul, give me the CIA, give me the Middle East. You could create some sort of interest. Yeah, you got a lot of stuff to work with right there, and that's what I think they'll do, right?
Agreed.
It'll be simple. Anyway, all right. Well, listen, God, it's been, I think, an hour and 10 minutes.
An hour and like 10 minutes, yeah.
I got things to do. I gotta start getting ready for the poll attacks. So
I gotta watch last night's Revenge finale.
Revenge. I don't watch. I
the show's terrible. Now, even like the actors were like, I want to get killed off the show.
My
one of them said that. So that shows.
My problem now is that even when like I'm so tired right now, is like at the normal time where I would go to sleep, like, okay, I finished work, kids asleep, time to go to bed. Like, I'm like, all right, well, maybe I can knock out one more episode of Scandal tonight. And so I end up staying up till like 1:30, 2 o'clock every single morning. And so like last night I knocked out after everybody fell asleep and after all the rankings were done and everything I was doing last night for work was done, I still watched two episodes of Scandal.
I had the entire first season I finished in a day. I had food poisoning. It was like two springs ago. And I watched like the first season. I'm like, 36 hours.
Oh, the first season I watched in one day. Like when
it was just like seven episodes.
Yeah, it was like seven episodes. I watched that in one day. But now I'm so like, I'm to the point now where like, here's the, so you can't get Netflix on planes. Like even with Wi-Fi, it just will not stream. But on my phone, I have Netflix, right? So like there's a good 20 minutes every single time you get on a plane. There's
you're
a good
sneaking in 20 minutes of that.
Okay, so there's like a 20 minute. You get on the plane and then before you actually get too far in the air to where you can't, your phone can't pick up Wi-Fi anymore, or like
3G.
Yeah, there's about 20-25 minutes before you, when you're taking off, and about another 20-25 when you land. When you touch down, you got about another 20 minutes before you get to the gate and get off the plane, which is always like, people get so like, that stupid bell rings and people are like,
they
jump,
leap up and grab,
and where are you people going? Where are you going? They're not opening the doors for another 6 minutes at least. When you're parked at the gate and that bell rings, everybody jumps up. Like I had some lady the other day, she was like, because I was sitting on the aisle, she was like, well, excuse me. I'm like, she's like, are you getting up? I'm like, I'll get up if you want to get up. But like, where are you going? Like where
you got Scandal to watch?
You
man.
Just do you just want to stand up? So the point is, I hate those people. I hate those people just as much as I hate the other people I was talking about earlier. And so you have about another 20-25 minutes before you actually can get off the plane. So like yesterday on the way home, I was knocking out Scandal. I had to fly from Raleigh to Atlanta, then Atlanta to Memphis. And so I was knocking out Scandal episodes like on takeoff. And then you realize like you're the grown man watching Scandal on your phone, which is a little embarrassing, right? Because I did do like some research on it, and the audience for that show is overwhelmingly female, right?
Yeah,
like it's mostly women watching.
That's never stopped me from watching anything.
Right. Me neither, right? Listen, I'm talking about it publicly. I'm not ashamed. But like I could just see like some manly man sitting right beside me in first class, like looking over. So what are you up to? Oh, nothing, dude. Just catching up on Scandal.
This brings everything together. I tweeted about Scandal the other day and how it was like probably the best show on TV right now. Bunch of dudes tweeted back at me. Are you serious, bro?
Yeah, dudes are stupid. I don't trust dudes.
And like it's Scandal, all right?
Yeah, like 75% of the audience, I think what I read, is female. But like I don't listen. If you watch that show,
there's nothing really inherently female about it.
No, and except for it's this.
The main character is a female.
No, the main character is a female. Here's why females love it. The main character is a female, and it's about chasing some love that you can't have, which is something most females can relate to. Right? Am I right? So that's what Norlander. Do you watch this show?
I don't, but I gotta admit that you guys have intrigued me enough that I am gonna bring it up to the wife. We're gonna knock out a
Paris,
few other things.
You're gonna be in trouble when you finish this one because season 3 won't come on Netflix for a while.
I know, but I can get it somewhere, right? iTunes, somewhere, ABC.com.
I got bootleg sites I can give to you. Bro.
Yeah, there's a place I'll get it. Like I'm not gonna wait until it comes out on DVD. I'll get it somewhere. But I think that's why women. I'd have to talk to women. I'm gonna talk to some women about this. But I think the reason women would like it is because the main character's female, and she's a strong, independent female who is also crippled by this love that she can't have. And I think that's something that resonates with females, isn't it? Like, there's every female in the world is going, God, I know what she's going through. You know, like, on some level, not being in love with the President of the United States, but
everyone can relate to that.
I think it's very simple. Yeah. I think it's like a Counting Crows song. Like, everybody can relate to being like every female. Okay, there's a strong in it, because every girl, you talk to every girl, they're not all strong, independent females. Like, everybody likes to say
they want to be, though.
They all want to be. Like, go look at their Facebook status updates. They all went, I'm a strong, independent. What? No, you're not. Shut up. All right. But they all want to be, and they all think they are. Okay. So what you have here in this character, this Olivia Pope character, is a strong, independent female who is also crippled because she's chasing a love that she cannot have. And I think that resonates with literally millions and millions of females.
She's also got the best walk on TV.
And she walks, and she's great looking.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So, like, so listen, I'm not ashamed of it. Like, I'm down with Scandal. And to the guys out there that are being skeptical, here's what I would tell you. It is rooted in all of the scenarios that these people end up in. All of the issues that they face are mostly realistic issues. So they resonate with people. Now the plot lines are totally unrealistic, right? Like, it gets a little silly. But if you look at what each character is going through, what Fitz is going through, what Melly's going through, what Olivia's going through, you can relate to one of those characters. And so I think that's I think it's good. And beyond that, it's just entertaining.
Like, third season's the best one, I'll tell you that.
Okay, Borzello. Well, look, I'm gonna knock out the Politex.
I'm just trying to get you amped up for the third season.
I can't wait. I'm so excited about it. All right, let's wrap this up. First, thanks you guys for being here, and then to everybody else for listening, to the podcast, reading what we write, interacting with us on Twitter. Even if you're one of the people that I say I hate on Twitter, I still appreciate you. You drive me crazy, but I appreciate you, and I'm sure Brazil and Norlander do as well. Remember,
5-minute podcast.
You can subscribe to the Ion College Basketball Podcast at iTunes. That's the quickest way to get it. So go do that, and either way, I'll talk to you again a little later on this week. Take care.